You may think of the plague, if you think of the plague, known scientifically as Yersinia pestis, as a thing of the past. But recent research on the genome of the disease says it could be part of our future, too.
Gemma Tarlak joins us now to share the details of this and other top news stories in the world of science. She's senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, and she joins us once a month. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello, and a very happy, hopefully plague-free Monday to you.
And it's a little scary what Rob just said, that the plague could be part of our future, but it seems as though there have been these lingering questions around the plague and what we know about it, so we haven't been really able to put it to rest. What are we learning now?
Well, you know, the really fascinating thing is if you say the plague or the Black Death, everyone knows what you're talking about, right? We immediately think of the medieval period and a little bit later, a 300-year period in our history when there was a very good chance that you or someone you knew was going to die of plague. But, you know, for all we know about it, we didn't really know what it was, where it came from. We couldn't really understand it on a genetic basis. And it's really been in the past few years that they have been able to actually isolate a sample from London, from a late Middle Ages cemetery, plague cemetery, and actually sequence the genome and understand what the plague was then and confirm that it is still with us. It's the same scourge that's been with us for centuries. And, it can make a big comeback.
Well, yeah, and before we get to that comeback, this was an open debate. We had this disease that exists in the present day, not as widespread, thankfully, and there was an argument. Some people didn't believe that it was the same disease that killed, what, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people in Europe and elsewhere, and now we've locked this down.
Yeah, and it's been in the past few years that we have the genetic evidence that proves from this, you know, plague cemetery victim, that proves the plague that decimated populations hundreds of years ago is the same organism that is with us today. And, you know, just in 2015, 16 people in the United States were infected with plague, and four of them died. So even though we don't hear about it that often, it's still with us. It's still kind of there right under the radar.
And not always under the radar, right? I mean, the story in Discover opens with a mountain lion that dies, and it's not what it seems like. It's modern plague, right?
Yeah, exactly. And unfortunately, the wildlife biologist who was studying the animal to figure what killed it contracted the plague and died from it. So these are, you know, they might not be making headlines all the time, but there are these cases kind of bubbling under the radar all the time.
Now, we're a different place with different hygiene, different medical system than medieval Europe, I think mostly for the better. is there a thought that, I mean, plague could somehow evolve, change to be a threat again in the modern day?
Yeah, and you know, one of the really interesting aspects of the new research is that they're going back and they're looking at these trees in Central Asia that have been around for 1,000 years, the same trees. They live a really long time. And they're able to look at the tree rings and determine what climate was like. And the researchers linked those climate indicators to outbreaks of the plague. So they were able to figure out that there's actually a cyclical climate pattern that can promote the perfect conditions for plague. And with climate change becoming more and more of a reality every day, I mean, you just have to look at the weather stories out there to see it in action. Basically, we are kind of setting the world up for some great opportunities for plague to get a foothold. It has to do with global transit. It has to do with conditions that cause the rodent population, where plague likes to hang out the most. It causes those rodent populations to collapse, and then the fleas that carry the plague have to look for, you know, a new place to live. They have to get a new apartment, so they hop on the nearest camel or horse or human.
So are there any cautionary lessons to be learned from some of this research yet, or is it still too early?
It's still a work in progress. And, you know, we have made advances in terms of how we treat plague, how we can diagnose it, et cetera. So the chances for a Black Death-size outbreak are not what they were in the year 1348, believe me. But that said, it's still a threat, and it's still something we have to plan for. The good news is science has really upped its game in the plague department, and we have a much better understanding of it now.
Stupid question to end with, Gemma.
I love stupid questions.
Yeah, plague, bacteria that antibiotics might work on, or virus that they won't?
Oh, No. It's a plague. It's a plague. Yes, it's a plague. But it's a bacteria, and antibiotics are effective against it until it develops resistance.
Right. Yeah.
And just as part of this, I want to bring out that struck me. Apparently, these microorganisms, some of them that were used to sequence DNA, are found in the pulp of teeth. Is that scientists got this material from?
Exactly. That plague victim that I mentioned that was found in what we knew was a plague cemetery. In other words, a mass burial ground where they only put victims of the plague. It was from the tooth that they were able to extract this information.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine about some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science. Let's do a 180, Gemma, from a thing that killed lots and lots of humans to research into why humans are living longer, some people and some places living past 100. So genetics, what are we looking at when it comes to the genetics of people who live to 100?
Well, we're looking at a lot of different things, and this is another area where science is uncovering all of these new aspects of even looking at the process of aging. And, you know, you can reduce the stress in your life, you can eat healthily, you can get exercise, have a really positive support network of friends and family, but the truth is the biggest factor to making it to 100 with a good quality of life, you got to win the genetic lottery. And there are a lot of different aspects that we see. Part of it is you may have protective genes that help you ward off pathogens. The flip side of it is you may have genes that predispose you towards getting a disease, and that makes it harder to reach the magical 100 number. And also, there's this thing called methylation. And I know we've talked about it a little bit before previously, but basically, it's in the field of epigenetics, they look at the ways environmental factors can really actually turn genes on and off, change how your DNA expresses itself, and that can also open you up to a lot of different diseases. So there's a ton of different things, and just even within the genes, they're finding that genes age at different rates within the cells, and this is just really kind of on the vanguard, and it's fascinating research, but you got to win the genetic lottery to C100.
Well, and it sounds like part of this is that we may have kind of an aging clock within us, and someone else's clock might be kind of slow and they're lucky. Mine might be faster and I'm less lucky. So how do we tease all of that out?
Yeah, exactly. And that has to do really with telomeres. They're basically the caps on the ends of the chromosomes, and they wear away. Each time the cell divides, they wear a little bit away. Now, some people have longer telomeres and they wear away more slowly. Other people, well, you know, they kind of got the short end of the stick genetically, so to speak, and their telomeres wear away faster. And as soon as the telomere is worn away, that cell basically dies, and it does not replicate. And it's just that's one of the reasons there are a lot of diseases in old age that are very specific to your cells dying. And they are just trying to figure out, they're just starting to figure out why the telomeres are different lengths, why they wear away, what causes them to wear away faster or slower. They're just getting to the bottom of it. So maybe in a couple of years we can have this conversation again and I have some concrete goodies to report. But right now it's just really at the dawn of this. It's in its infancy.
Right. Is the thought, though, that by doing this research, understanding the ways people age differently, the way these clocks work differently, that there will be some kind of potential for applied science down the road so that if we want this to happen, more people live to 100?
Yeah, you know, that's always the hope. It's always the hope. I mean, that's why they're doing this research, to really understand it and then figure out how to manipulate these natural processes. But, you know, it's so early that you just don't want to say, yes, this is going to help us all live to 120 and we'll all still be driving our cars and leaving the left blinker on as we do. But, you know, it's too early to say.
And before we switch topics for our last story, I got to ask you about blue zones because, well, basically I want to move there. It sounds like this is the place to be if you want to live past 100. What are these blue zones and why do people live so long there?
Yeah, you know, there are these five different zones in Japan, Greece, Italy, and Costa Rica. There's also one in Loma Linda, California. It's the only U.S. site. And people just have an excellent chance of living to 100 or beyond. There are a lot of different factors. Some of these zones, it has to do with people you know, a lot of people from the same family or same extended relations living there, so they have their genetic lottery all in one spot. But it has to do also with some lifestyle changes. They tend to have a leisurely pace of life and eat a plant-based diet, and again, they have that really positive support network of friends and family. So it's a lot of different factors, but really it's the genes really underlying their chances of seeing, 100 candles on their next birthday cake.
And Gemma, finally, I want to go out into space now. Not literally. I think there'd be a lot of motion sickness there. But out in a mysterious neighborhood on the edge of our solar system, scientists may be discovering another planet?
Yeah, the mysterious Planet Nine. We are always, it's kind of embarrassing. We know so much about space, and yet we know so little. We're always finding stuff in our own solar system. Planet Nine has been theorized for a long time. It is a massive planet. They're saying it's, 10 times the mass of Earth. So it's a big, big planet. And it's way, way out there, way, way beyond Pluto and the Kuiper Belt, which is that zone around Pluto that has all kinds of goodies in it. And basically, it could be on a 5 to 100 billion mile away from the sun orbit. We're talking potentially 100 billion miles away from the sun. It has this huge orbit, and we don't know that it's there by observing the light that it gives us, because we haven't seen it. We only know it's there because of its gravity. And, as it swings around in this enormous orbit, it kind of pushes everything else out of the way. And because we're seeing stuff get pushed out of the way, that's how researchers think that this huge thing is out there. And they're hoping, they're embarking on a new phase of research, looking for it to confirm it. And hopefully we'll hear something in the next couple of years, for sure.
Oh, really? So a couple of years. So what are they, it says we can't see this thing, and we're relying on the math to show that gravitation is pushing stuff out of the way. What do they need to do to actually prove that it's there?
How much time do you have?
In 10 seconds or less.
Yeah, okay. Basically, they're going to use a new telescope to really dig in there and see if we can identify either for sure by its gravitational pull what it's doing out there, or maybe even see that faint, faint light.
You actually had a little more than 10 seconds.
You did well, though.
Yeah, that was great.
Oh, you played me, man.
Yeah. What's the next step? We're actually trying to do this? We've got this telescope fired up?
Well, the telescope is existing, but, researchers, they can't just, show up one day at the telescope and say, hey, let me hop on this thing for a couple minutes. They have to apply for time. And we're right now in the position where Mike Brown, the researcher from Caltech, is in the process of saying, please, 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 please let me have some time on this telescope. As you can imagine, a lot of astronomers want a piece of that telescope. So we're not sure he's going to be able to do it, but I think he's made a fantastic case for being able to do it.
Gemma, thanks so much for being with us today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Gemma Tarlak. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month to talk about some of the most exciting news from the world of science and technology.